This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Silas House is known as one of the major writers of his generation here in the South. He was born in and grew up in Kentucky, where he lives to this day. Silas is a nationally best-selling writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, and he has been a commentator on NPR. His first three novels, Clay's Quilt, A Parchment of Leaves, and The Cole Tattoo, have just been reissued. Those novels are deeply Southern Appalachian, and they speak to this part of Tennessee as much as they resonate in Kentucky, North Carolina, and Southern Virginia.
Silas, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you here, albeit virtually, but that's how we do it these days. Now, you are from Kentucky, and you have written so much about your life experience and the culture of Appalachia, of Southern Appalachia. There are folks listening who know your name, know your voice, know your words. There are other folks listening here who might be hearing you for the first time. Tell me how you began your journey as a writer.
Well, I just love to read, you know, as long as I can remember. I always love to read and I love to write. I was really lucky to grow up around people who encouraged that, even though they weren't readers themselves. I think one of the pivotal moments for me was I had a great English teacher in seventh grade, and she recognized something in me, you know, and really encouraged me as a reader and as a writer. She was the first person I ever knew who loved literature and was passionate about it. And knowing her gave me permission to be passionate about it, you know. And so from there on, I was determined to be a writer from seventh grade. And so all through high school and college, I was working on stories. And one day in college, a friend of mine said to me, why don't you write something set right here? Because always before that, you know, I had this, like a lot of people from the South, the whole culture is telling you that you're not worthy or you should be ashamed of where you're from, if you're from a rural place, especially. And so I was writing stuff set in Hawaii and, you know, places I'd never been at all. And so I started writing this story set in my fictionalized version of where I'm from, and it became Clay's Quilt. And about 7 years after I started that in a college class, it was published.
How much do you think during your life and your work as a writer that perception that you sensed as a child of don't write about where you're from, how much do you think that has changed either within this region or among people on the outside looking in?
I think when you write about rural America, you're still punished by the powers that be in the literary world, in academia. I think that, you know, Willa Cather is one of my favorite writers. And her most famous book is My Aunt Tania. Came out in 1918. She's from Nebraska. Well, she's originally from Virginia, but is most identified with Nebraska. When that book came out, which is now considered a masterpiece, a classic, one reviewer said, "Who cares what happens in Nebraska?" And so that sentiment still exists, I think. You know, I have had people say to me, "Why should I read a book set in Kentucky?" You know, they've said that right to my face. So I do think that's one reason that I love to write, is to complexify the ideas about rural people, about Southern people, about working class people. When my first book came out, I was a rural mail carrier. And I was really lucky. I got a lot of media in USA Today and Newsday and all these big publications. But I began to realize that the reason I was getting all that media was because people were amazed that a blue-collar worker had written a book that was on the New York Times bestseller list. You know, people just couldn't wrap their minds around that. And if you think too much about that, that's really insulting to working-class people. You know, this idea that working-class people can't be eloquent or literate or whatever. And so I think realizing all those things made me a better writer and made me more determined to tell the stories of my people
And what are some of those stories that you have told that have really stood out when you go back and think about them, especially in how they might complexify how people outside of where you're from view Appalachia and view the South?
I think the main thing for me is that I believe that romanticizing a place is just as bad as vilifying it. And I see both things happen. And I always want to write about the gray. You know, I want to write about the complexity. I don't want it to be romanticized or vilified. I want it to be the truth about the place. You know, and the writers that I admire, that's what they've done. And my main writing mentor has been Lee Smith, who I just think of as, you know, the height of Southern literature among living writers. And that's what she always did. She portrayed characters who were human beings who happened to live in the South. They happened to live in Appalachia. They happened to live in rural places. And so I think that taught me a great lesson that the human story is the most important thing. If I go into it with this agenda, I'm going to educate people about what people are really like. That's not what I want to do. I just want to show people as they are and tell these human stories, you know. But I have wanted to show a complex range of characters. I mean, my last novel that came out in 2018 before these reissues was called Southernmost, and it really explores LGBTQ issues in the South. And so in that book, I was really trying to look at the spectrum of all the way from somebody who's very homophobic to somebody who's completely accepting and everybody in between. And in doing that, what I was trying to illuminate was that the South is not the other. The South is a mirror when we think about America. And I think people tend to think of the South always as the other, but I always think of it as it's just a mirror. It's just an exaggerated version of what's going on in the United States.
And you mentioned the reissues. These are the reissues of your first three novels, loosely tied Appalachian trilogy.
Yeah, they cover from the 1830s up until about the year 2000. So a long period of Southern history, American history, all through the point of view of one family. So it is a family saga in that way. But at the same time, they are not written so that they depend on each other. In other words, you can just read one of them if you want to, or you can read the whole trilogy if you want to. If you want to spend 900 pages with this family, you can, or you can just spend 300 pages with them, you know. I didn't know they were connected until I wrote the last one, because the last one brings them together.
Well, all this talk of reading, I think it's time for a little reading.
Okay. I'm going to read the opening paragraph from The Cold Tattoo. It's one of my favorite things that I've ever written. And this takes place, you'll probably realize, in the 1950s. Aneth was dancing in her tight red dress, and everyone was watching her. The way she closed her eyes and felt the music running up and down the backs of her legs, the way the curls trembled down in her eyes as she threw her hair about, stomping her feet with one leg proudly thrust through the high slit that ran up one side of her dress. And it was like seeing joy made into a human form that could travel across the dance floor. It was like seeing the music itself. Every part of her was moving. Her hips met the beat of drums. Her bare feet matched the riffs on the guitar. She had kicked off her shoes as soon as the first strains of Maybelline came on the jukebox. She didn't wait for anyone to ask her to go out on the dance floor with them. She didn't stop to grab a man. She liked dancing alone, although no one ever danced by themselves at the Hilltop Club. There was a scattering of couples along the edges of the floor, but she was in the middle, and all eyes were upon her. So what I wanted to do there was I wanted to arrive at the moment that rock and roll arrives in this little country Appalachian town. And so to me, this character, Anna, she is a little bit country and a little bit rock and roll. And this is the moment when those things come together. You know, I mean, we think of Maybelline as a quintessential rock and roll song, you know, and it's arguably, it is one of the first rock and roll, true rock and roll songs. However, it's also a song that was originally a country song that Chuck Berry then, you know, rocked out on and turned it into something totally different. And so I think, to me, that's a big signal to the reader that this is about a changing place. I never want the South that I write about to be still. You know, I want it to be a place that is changing and moving and things are happening. It's a global place as well as a local place.
When you write something like that, how much of it comes to you, and then how much of it do you have to craft and recraft? Because you don't want to do that too much. You lose the essence of what came to you in the first place when you had that idea.
Well, I do love craft, you know, but I think the magic happens in the initial moment of something coming to you. That's what's the supernatural part of writing, is the imagination, right? But then the really fun part, I think, for most writers is the crafting of it. And so, for instance, I had this image of this woman dancing with wild abandon by herself in this red dress to this song that is sort of thematic for the whole book. But then what I crafted was that first sentence is very, very long, and I'm trying to establish the rhythm of the music itself. So if you read that aloud and listen to the song, they match their tempo to some degree. And I'm trying to put you in that bar, you know, with her dancing, and I want it to be active and image driven, and I want you to hear it. And I'm trying to summon all of the senses: see, hear, taste, feel, smell. So that's the main craft, you know, is just trying to make a movie pop in the reader's mind when they're reading those words. And I love all that. I love that act of creation.
And it's an act of creation, whether we're talking about the written word or the spoken word, and the rich tradition of storytelling in both of those modes in this area.
Yeah. And I think that's something that not enough writers think about, is that if it doesn't sound good read aloud, it's not going to feel as good when you're reading it silently. So I don't ever put anything out into the world unless I have read it aloud. And then I'll read it aloud, I'll fine tune, I'll read it aloud again, I'll finesse, you know, I'll worry over the sentence. Because you should be able to read something without ever hitting a snag. And that's how you know you've gotten it right. Because the way it sounds aloud is the way it'll sound in the reader's mind. And you want them to be on that smooth road, you know, you want it to flow.
And these novels, which have been reissued, that we have been talking about, Clay's Quilt, A Parchment of Leaves, and The Cold Tattoo, you have something else from that trilogy that you'd like to share.
Yeah, I'll read a little bit from the first chapter of Clay's Quilt. Now, this book was my first published novel. If you were reading this trilogy, if you wanted to read them chronologically, it would be the last one because it's set in the year 2000, whereas Parchment of Leaves starts in 1914 but has flashbacks to the 1800s. But what I really wanted to do with this book was I wanted to write as contemporary a novel as I could about the rural South. And so because I couldn't find many, you know, I couldn't find any book about Generation X in a rural place. When you found Generation X literature, it was all set on the coast and it was all wealthy people. And it was usually like kids in boarding schools, you know, that sort of thing. So I put Generation X and rural America in this book. Clay slid his blackened coveralls down his legs, jerked them off, and tossed the hard clump of clothing into the back of the truck. Coal dust twinkled on the metal of the truck bed. He put his work boots back on and pulled off his t-shirt, sailing it through the window and onto the floorboard. Already his chest glistened with the sweat of July sun. It was hot and white, and all up the hillside's tangled trumpet vines wilted and thirsted. The blacktop of the parking lot glistened, so soft it threatened to seep down the hillside. There was only the hint of a breeze, and it felt as forced and tired as the heavy-footed men who made their way out of the coal mine. The men laughed and loudly called out their goodbyes. They climbed into their trucks, ground gears, and set out for home. They told Clay not to get too drunk this weekend, not to get into any fights when he was out honky-tonking. They loved it that every Monday he told them big tales about barroom brawls and drunken women while the miners leaned against the black walls of the earth and took their lunch. They all liked Clay. They called him Baby Boy since he was the youngest man on the crew, and they all had nicknames. They talked with cigarettes bobbing up and down in their mouths, feeling deep in their pockets for their keys as they left. As Clay got into his truck, they all hollered out in sing-song voices, "Bye-bye, baby boy. Be good this weekend now." Clay wheeled his truck carefully down the steep incline of road that led to US 25. Once off the company road and onto the highway, he shifted gears and laid rubber on the road, his tires issuing little barks. He passed two of the men who had gotten out before him, laughed into his rearview mirror, and gave them the finger as he passed. He liked the way the ball of the gear shift felt, all cool and shiny, covered up in his fist. His big hands slid over the steering wheel with ease as he sped down the road, shifting gears and pushing the gas all the way to the floor. He loved the rough purr of the engine and the smooth sound of tires humming on hot pavement. With one motion, he clicked a cassette into his player, and Steve Earle started singing, "I Ain't Ever Satisfied." And so even though it was as contemporary as possible at the time, now I read about a cassette being flicked into a player, and it sounds...
That's true, but we're both old enough to remember that was daily life.
Yes. Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to talk about in reading up a little bit about you is activism, and I'm thinking specifically about mountaintop mining and all that you have written about that over the years. How did you come to that?
Well, I grew up in a coal mining community, in a family of coal miners. Most of the men in my family made their livings through the coal mines, except for my father, who was a mechanic. And, you know, we thought about coal as something that just brought us about a poverty and was a really great thing. But then when I was a child, one day I came out onto the front porch and there were two bulldozers sitting across the road, and the woods and the ridge that was my whole world, you know, where I played every day, the most important place in the world to me. Then for the next 2 years, it was destroyed. It was being devastated. And we as a community had to put up with that every day, the dust and the noise and the road was destroyed and et cetera. And so it made me have really complex thoughts about coal mining, because on one hand, I knew that it had brought my family out of deep poverty. But on the other hand, I saw that it had destroyed the place that I loved. And so I just started to think a lot about how, you know, yes, natural resources, we need them. However, there's a responsible way to get them, and that just wasn't being done in our community. The other part of it is I think that we don't need to be as dependent on natural resources as we're made to believe. You know, where I live in Kentucky, for instance, the representatives here have done a really good job of not allowing solar energy to come in, of not allowing wind energy to come in. That sort of forces me to believe that the coal and the oil industries are lining their pockets. Why else wouldn't they want these new industries to come in? And so in 2005, I published The Coal Tattoo, one of the books that's just been reissued. And it's a book that deals with some of these issues. But I had never spoken out as an environmentalist. You know, I didn't feel like that I had a voice to do that. I didn't know how to do that. But Wendell Berry, much to my... It just humbles me to even think about, he had read the book, and he called me and he said, "You know, you've written this book, that it's an environmental book, and I want you to go with me to a mountaintop removal site and tour it. And people from the region really need to start speaking out about this." And so that began my real education. Before that, you know, I was a member of the community who saw it happening, but I then was really educated by scientists, environmentalists, engineers, and things like that. And so I became informed enough, I felt, that I could speak about it publicly. And what I really wanted to do was complexify the conversation, because when you're from a coal mining culture, if you speak out against coal in any way, you're seen as a traitor. And I wanted to talk about how it was more about devastation and how it could be done more responsibly. And I also wanted to remind people that most of the money made by it was leaving the region. And it, you know, the people who were really making the money off of it were people who lived away from here, even overseas, most of them. And so I was very involved in the environmental justice movement for about 6 or 7 years. When you're deeply involved in a social justice movement, you have to step back every once in a while. You have to pull back and let younger people take charge, and you have to rejuvenate. And so I have taken a more behind-the-scenes role now. I still write about it and I still speak about it, but I'm not out marching in the streets as often. The other thing is, there's so many wars to be fought right now that you have to distribute what you're working on at each time. But my new novel, which will be out, I think, in a couple of years, I should say. I'm not sure when it'll be out, but it is a climate change novel. And so it goes back to those environmentalist roots, you know, that I care so deeply about. The thing that just terrifies me is how little we as Americans care about our water supply. And that just boggles my mind. I mean, water is life. Of all things that should be protected, water should be. Yet we're sitting by while so many regulations are rolled back on our water. Never, ever should clean water be taken for granted. So that's what this new novel's about. It's about, if we take our water for granted, eventually it's going to come back to bite us.
How are you living and working during this pandemic? What are you seeing? What are you hearing from people around you? And you're part of Kentucky. You're part of Appalachia.
People always ask me how I'm doing during the pandemic. And I always say, we're doing great, except for the state of the world. You know, I mean, my life didn't change that much in that, you know, for a writer, a world of quiet and stillness is a real blessing. And you're trying to always gain those times. And the pandemic gave me more of that for sure. As much as I love being on the road and meeting readers and traveling all over the place, it has been wonderful to not have to leave home. That has made me much more productive as an artist. It's made me feel really lucky to have the kind of job where I can stay home, because so many people are not able to do that. And I think that it's really troubling to see the way a virus has been politicized. That's scary. But I think for the most part, you know, I feel guilty sometimes saying that it's been sort of a beautiful time for me as a writer, and to be with my son. Had to move back in with us because of the pandemic. He just graduated from college right in the middle of it, and that's been great to be with him after being an empty nester for a few years, you know. Probably not as good for him as it has been for us, but anyway, it has had positives. But at the same time, it's so sad to see people suffering and to see the economy suffering. So I just think it's a paradigm shift. This will change us tremendously in ways that we don't even know yet, you know. And that's interesting. I wrote a piece about the pandemic for The Atlantic. I hope people might look it up. If you just go to The Atlantic and type in my name, it'll come right up.
Another thing we should talk about is podcasting. You have gotten into podcasting, and your experience so far with that, how does that remind you of writing? How does that remind you of reading and the rest of the spoken word? And how is it a completely new thing that you're still trying to settle into?
Well, my show is called On the Porch. And so if you can go to wherever you get your podcast and search for that, and it should come up. I interview writers and activists and actors and musicians. And I just think that talking to other artists and activists just feeds me. You know, it inspires me. And I just want my podcast to feel as if the listener is eavesdropping on two people talking on the porch, you know, so we just have conversations just like we're doing, right? And so I really love doing that. I especially love it because it allows me to introduce writers and musicians and people that I really admire and that I love their work to other people. That's one of the best things about it.
Where can people go online beyond the podcast to follow all that you do?
I'm on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. Of those three, what I enjoy most is Instagram. On Instagram, it's mostly positive. And on Twitter and Facebook, it's not. So, yeah, I'm on all those if people want to look for me and follow me. And I try to share informative, positive stuff as much as I can. And every once in a while, I feel like I have to get on a, you know, get up there and say my piece just like anybody else does. But I do think social media can be a much more positive place if we are conscious of that.
If we're actually social on social media.
Exactly. Social and civil. Yeah.
All right. Silas, thanks so much.
A real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
On Sunday at 2 p.m., Silas will be doing a virtual reading on Zoom for Union Avenue Books in Knoxville. More information at unionavbooks.indylight.org. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. This summer, we've brought you conversations with teaching artists in the Chattanooga area who have worked with our community in a learning residency through the Wolf Trap Program at UTC's Southeast Center for Education in the Arts, or SCEA. Angela Dittmar is Director of Teaching Artist Residencies and Affiliate Director of the Wolf Trap Program at SCEA, which will soon acquire a new identity.
Angela, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ray.
We should start off by talking about how the center's identity is shifting.
We are changing our name. It will be formally shifting in August and announced with grand announcements the second week of September in honor of National Arts and Education Week. The name will be ArtSpace Collaborative, although the roots are strong. The focus is still very much tied to those roots of infusing our world with more arts because of we believe how much we thrive and grow through the arts. We're focused on first day ready skills through the arts and knowing that everybody has first days at all walks of life. And that's, you know, part of our mission is to support that.
So ABC at UTC.
ABC at UTC, maybe a little dive with it.
It's more of rebranding in a way that captures what you all have been doing for years than anything else. It's more about adopting a name that is more apt to what you're already doing and poised to do next.
Yes, exactly. We thrive on being in relationships. We thrive in partnerships. The more people at the table, the more impact we can make, and we make that together. So we're growing through having teaching artists. We're growing with having partnerships with other arts organizations, other campus community members and departments, and other partnerships throughout the community. And so we have been doing this and growing that in that way, and we want our name to reflect that.
So tell us more about your work there as Director of Teaching Artist Residences.
I feel like I have the best job. I love my job. I love doing what I get to do. And that is working with artists of different professions, different genres, different expertise, bringing creative play, creative engagement into experiences with teachers, with partners, again, with their constituents. So I get to work firsthand with artists of all sorts. And I'm an artist myself, and I'm passionate about using arts and teaching focus or a lens for experiences and making connections. That's one of the things I really believe. And so I get to connect across different disciplines through working with my artists. We have a roster of 8 teaching artists who have been active in virtual residencies right now. So we're growing together in the current circumstances. Right now, they're primarily performing artists. We also have, I come from a visual arts background. We have 5 musicians on our roster, 2 drama artists, and 1 dancer. And we hope to continue to grow our roster. Lori Allen, our executive director, comes from a drama background as well, a theater for the young audience and young artists. She is passionate about how drama and the arts can infuse and enhance life and connections as well. We have Joel Baxley, who's also another visual artist, and we work with Lee Harris as well in music. In my job, I get to work firsthand with just amazing people who are creative and innovative. We're also building a visual arts roster, so we've been reaching out to some local artists to engage their interest in working as teaching artists with us.
So what's it like as an artist from one field working across other disciplines of art?
As an artist, a visual artist working with musicians or working with drama artists, we start to see how some of those principles are so common across disciplines. You know, we can see how visual art language is rooted in drama and composition when you're looking at a theater or a stage. I could see how musicians composing and working improvisationally can relate to the drama artists in the improvisational ways. So I think it's inspiring for artists of multiple disciplines to get to collaborate together and share their expertise, share what they are inspired by, and then to create things together.
These teaching artists are working with partners in the community, such as healthcare. And I see from your background that you spent some time working for CHI Memorial between your stints at UTC's Department of Art and your role now at UTC. Tell me what that experience added to your perspective in the role that you do now.
That's a great question, Ray. I, you know, really loved my time at CHI Memorial. I was an outreach worker and I worked in the marketing department as well. And I often hosted wellness programs where I got to lead creative writing engagements in a sort of holistic manner with the idea that well-being, you're at a hospital, you're at a clinic, but there's more to health and well-being than just, right, the ways that physicians serve us. And CHI Memorial supports very much the well-being of the whole person. So I gained a lot of practical skills. I learned a lot from our marketing director and VP, Lisa McCluskey, and organizational skills. But I also got to see how the arts in that environment could complement and nurture and repair patients and individuals in all working environments as well. I serve now currently on their Arts for Healing Council. They're building a robust program for creative arts therapies in the presence of arts of all forms in the hospital. And so seeing how arts support well-being firsthand in a hospital has been really profound for me and has influenced the way I've seen how the arts can integrate in other sectors of life, other areas of life beyond the classroom, and how important it is for us as adults to continue to pursue nurturing our creative sides and our well-being that way.
Because when the arts are integrated in daily life that way, we're not talking about something abstract anymore.
No, it's not abstract. Our minds need respite through distraction, through expression. We find ourselves in expression. We find out our problems through expression, the things that are weighing on our hearts and our souls. And often there's a direct, you know, there's more and more studies of the relationship between what weighs on us emotionally and how it impacts our body and our well-being. And I will say that as an abstract artist, an artist who thrives with figures and forms visually that are more abstracted, I find that the place where I can start to think through things that are pressing right now. That the answers are a little bit disguised in those abstractions.
And since they're disguised, what's something that you have learned in your role there? And what's something that you keep learning over and over again as part of that creative process of discovery?
I have been really impressed with how I see that the arts in this field, in my role, that I can support how important it is to make connections across disciplines, across thought processes, to open up our thought into more flexible spaces. And so I've learned how to literally collaborate with teachers to co-teach something where two forms that normally might have been taught in different classrooms, different contexts, are coming together to support understanding and support expression and goals that co-evolve, that evolve together and present opportunities for intrinsic connections, intrinsic interest, and how important it is for us as individuals to be self-realized through those natural interests that we have in life, to learn about life through the things that draw our eyes. So I see that happening when we embrace an integrated model, an integration of an art form and a science, or a math and an art, or drama artists in a program that Lori has been building, working with nursing students in patient simulation. So to embrace these two worlds, to embrace more things that normally might have existed in their own entities as autonomous from each other, when we bring those things together, we thrive even more. And so I'm continually looking for how can we make opportunities to make more connections, to increase the matrix and the nebulous of connections and points.
And if people want to connect with the center as it is now rebranding, where can they go online to start?
They can go to utc.edu/SCEA. That's our current website. Our new website as of August 1st will be Artspace Collaborative at UTC. So I believe you'll be able to go to utc.edu/ABC. But either way, if you Google the Southeast Center for Education and the Arts, or you go to UTC and search in the search field for Southeast Center for Education and the Arts or Artspace Collaborative, you'll find us.
All right. Angela, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray.
Tomorrow night, the Sadi Daisy Community Library hosts the Magical Night of Literacy and Movie in the Park. The festival, to celebrate literacy and Harry Potter's birthday, takes place at Veterans Park from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Kelly Flemings is a co-founder of the library.
Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Ray.
Tell us how you folks are operating the library at this time.
Well, we've met a lot of the challenges head on ever since the shelter at home back in March. We did close the library to patrons for about 3 weeks, and we allowed for curbside pickup. And in that time, we still handed out about 1,200 books in just that 3 weeks' time because so many people were, you know, stuck at home, and it was time to finally have a chance to read that book they've been wanting. And then after that, we did open back up to allow patrons in, and we are currently open to allow patrons in. Masks are required. Social distancing is a must. And we also are quarantining all returned books for 72 hours before they're available for checkout again.
And of course, you rely on volunteers, and your volunteers are staying home because under these conditions, they have to stay home.
Definitely. We really do not want to take a chance with the health of any of our volunteers. A couple have come back in and out, but with the increase in cases that's going on right now, we've lost a lot of our volunteers again. So right now, there's just two or three of us running the library at this time.
As you are running the library at this time, you are planning for something at the end of this month, Magical Night of Literacy Festival and Movie in the Park.
Yes, and we are so excited to still be able to put this on. It's the culmination of our Magical Summer of Reading program, and it happens on Friday, starts at 7 o'clock. And the date was very important because that's Harry Potter's birthday, so everything is Harry Potter themed. We're very excited because we've been given permission by the city to take over Veterans Park in Sadi Daisy. So it's all going to be open air. We're going to be able to enforce social distancing and mask requirements and still be able to have the festival.
This is an opportunity not only to come out and enjoy under these conditions, but it's also an opportunity to come out and support the library and the Kelkirk Foundation.
We are going to be celebrating literacy from 7 to 9. We have crafts and games. We're giving away books to kids 18 and under. We have a scavenger hunt. We've got a costume contest. So put on your Harry Potter finery and come out and compete. And then at 9 o'clock, we're going to be having a movie in the park. And it's a very special movie about a young boy who discovers he's a wizard and gets to go to a magical school to learn how to use his powers.
That being the one and only Harry Potter.
We have a lot of wonderful partners that are going to be helping us out with this event. We've got the March of Dimes will be there, the Girl Scouts of the Southern Appalachians, Northside Neighborhood House will be there, Solutions Printing. We're hopefully going to have the Soddy Daisy Montlake Historic Society with a whole cauldron display. Lots of other great partners that are going to come out and support our community.
And if people want more information online, where can they go?
The best place is to go to our Facebook page. Just follow Soddy Daisy Community Library, or it's also the THESDCL.
All right, Kelly, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.